The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Manchester City win in a breathless game in Paris. Did Pep overthink the first half and just think the second? Was letting his players have fun the key? What happened to PSG? And after Mahrez's free kick, what are the long-term implications for the draft excluder? Elsewhere, Kevin Miles from the Excellent Football Supporters Association joins us to give us his take on the ESL and what fans can actually do. Real-life musician Philippe Auclair gives his thoughts on Spotify taking over his beloved Arsenal. Harry Kane hints that his Spurs time might be up. There's Marcelo's election duty, alligators on the pitch, all that plus your questions and a fancy new and modern way to contact us. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hello, Max.
Hello. Hello, Jordan Jarrett Bryan.
What's up, Max? You all right?
I'm good. I'm looking forward to some hot takes from you. And Philippe Auclair, welcome.
Hello, Max. Hello, everyone.
Right, Neil says, those Champions League semi-finals for great, weren't they? Do you think they should set up some kind of special league where the elite European teams can play each other much more often? Yeah, PSG 1, Manchester City 2. The quality of this game, Jordan, was ridiculous. I mean, just the pace of it. I mean, there were mistakes and there were bad tackles and all that, but the pace of it was just completely ridiculous.
Yeah, I think that this game, the timing of this game has come at a great time. Just a reminder that, as you kind of said in your intro there, that do we need a European Super League when you get to the latter points? I know Barry, like me, has no time for the early stages of this competition, but this is where the quality and the excitement, I think, really, really shines. And you've got two teams that are funded by states. They've got Uber money. And we saw it on the pitch. We saw that to De Bruyne. Even Neymar, I'm not a big Neymar fan, but I thought Neymar in patched in the first half was just ridiculous. He was really, really up for it. And I think, as we saw with Neymar, he faded when it really mattered. But to your point, the quality on this game was very, very high and highly enjoyable.
I tweeted last night, Barry, that people often say, you know, one of the beauties of football is that the game that I play in the park on a Saturday afternoon is the same as the game that the biggest stars are playing. And I was watching that game thinking, that is categorically not the case.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily agree, because while the game was exceptionally high on the kind of quality I suspect is conspicuous by its absence from the games you play, at least two of the goals that were conceded, specifically the ones by PSG, were on the back of errors that you would really criticise and get stuck into your teammates for if they were responsible for the mistakes that led to them. So, you know, even the best are capable of messing up from time to time, and there were, as you say, a lot of mistakes in the game. But, yeah, the quality was breathtaking at times.
It's interesting, Philippe, on that first City goal, I actually don't really blame Keylor Navas for that.
No.
I put that down as kind of one of those things. There's nothing a goalkeeper can do. There's a lot of luck involved in that.
There's a lot of luck, and in a way, in a strange way, the keeper in this put in this position would hope that somebody would actually touch the ball and head the ball. Is not one man land, two man land, no man land. I don't know how many men. He's in a land that is impossible to survey, impossible to protect.
The corridor of uncertainty.
It's the corridor of uncertainty. It's that bit just around the off stump. You don't quite know, you know, whether you should cover it with your bat or not. And in this particular case, because if he does, I mean, to actually touch the ball is really to the side of the goal anyway. If he actually got that ball, it would mean that his positioning at the beginning is wrong. So, and he's obviously expecting somebody is going to cut the trajectory of the ball. And he isn't. I mean, it is extraordinary difficult. And I wouldn't put that against Keylor Navas, who has been absolutely magnificent for PSG all through the campaign.
Can I slightly disagree? Sorry. I mean, no. Maybe I need to watch the goal again. But I think it was the keeper's fault. And from memory of watching things like the goal now, there was quite a lot of space between the last player and the ball going past him. It's not like it was whipped across and somebody ran across the keeper, missed the ball and it's gone in. There was a couple of seconds, I think, where he could have reacted to save that. So I actually think it was a goalkeeping error. I think it could have been stopped because there was a significant gap between the nearest player and the goalkeeper.
And one interesting thing is that if I look at the French media this morning and listening to my colleagues last night as well, Keylor Navas didn't get any real criticism for that goal. The Parisian wall did, but we'll come to that in a minute. So it's all about the wall. It's not about Navas missing out that ball. I mean, maybe he could have done better, but it's just one of those things, really.
It just got me thinking what a ridiculously good, fast, medium-paced bowler Kevin De Bruyne probably is with both arms, isn't he? Everyone just on the spot, and you just don't know whether to play forward or play back. Well, let's get onto the wall then. Jack saying, how would you rate the use of PSG's draft excluder? Could the draft excluder just have been used as an extra man in the wall? James says, since traditional walls are now so easy to breach, do teams need to start employing multiple draft excluders stacked up on top of each other? And Cam said, would Glenn Hoddle's hat of fly's hair done a better job of defending Riyad Mahrez's free kick than PSG's wall of professional footballers? So that's getting a stick in L'Équipe, is it?
Yeah, it's the front page. And you've got a picture, which is actually very good. Their front pages are usually absolutely fantastic. Remember the one with Kylian Mbappe being held on his coattails by Gerard Piqué. This is not quite as good, but the photograph is really well chosen. You can actually see how the wall is completely blinding the view of Keylor Navas. And you can see, it's actually, I'm looking at it right now, it's very funny. And the title, the headline is, At the Foot of the Wall. Which is an expression in French which means last chance saloon, basically. And I was wondering one thing about this wall. I mean, the fact is, the draft excluder, wasn't it introduced precisely because of Kevin De Bruyne? Do you remember?
Yes, and I think maybe Coutinho as well.
Yeah, but yeah. I think Kevin De Bruyne was the first to have this impish attempt at a free kick underneath the wall. But honestly, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say. He would have done better without the wall. Yes, quite clearly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we know turning your back is the biggest crime in football. Was it Verratti who was the draft excluder?
Yeah, it's Verratti who was the draft excluder.
Yeah. Because I was looking at that going, that must be a weird position to be in because you're basically lying there. He's facing the wrong way. So suddenly the ball just comes out of nowhere and goes in. It's a really sort of, you know, it's quite an exclusive place to be. Also, a disappointing, you know, there's nothing you can, just what a weird angle he gets of that goal that no one else gets.
Should we actually put like one of those GoPro cameras on their forehead?
100%.
Yeah, on the draft excluder, yeah. So we could have this fantastic view. You'd have the spider cam and you'd have the Verratti cam.
Mm.
I shouldn't have said that. They're going to do it, aren't they?
Yeah, they probably will, and sponsor it, you know. And, you know, some rogue nation will sponsor it, Philippe. And it'll be the Philippe Eau Claire Verratti cam sponsored by North Korea with your face. Barry, can you pinpoint what happened at halftime, what the difference was? Was it just City being quicker to the ball? Was there something hugely tactical that changed at halftime? Because PSG was so good in that first half.
Well, I spent the first half I texted a mate during the first half thinking and said, God, City could get a hiding here. I was genuinely concerned they could really be out of the semi-final by the hour mark in the first leg. And I was wondering, was Pep overthinking things again, or was I overthinking about the level of which he might be overthinking? And I think it was pretty straightforward adjustment. I mean, I obviously don't know what was said in the dressing room, but in the first half, the fullbacks weren't getting forward, and in the second half they did, and it just gave City a lot more options going forward.
You mentioned...
I think that it was that straightforward, and the better City got, the more PSG seemed to mentally disintegrate and lose the plot. And that's when the tackles started going in. That's when, or the bad tackles and the petulance and the kicking the ball away. And just they collectively couldn't keep their heads.
I think the second half will prove quite significant for Manchester City because it felt like they'd matured in the Champions League. We hear often about it took United 10 years to understand how to play in the Champions League. Chelsea took them, you know, a long time to learn how to play in the latter stages of the Champions League. And it felt to me like they'd realised this is the time now. We've got no excuse. We have the team. We have the manager. We have the past failures to learn from those mistakes. Now is the time to step up. I thought the second half performance was spectacular in an unspectacular way. I thought they did the basics really, really well. I do think they may rue not scoring the third goal. I think it seemed like there was a conscious effort to 2-1 is a really good result. We'll take that. I think a third goal kills the tie. And with 10 men PSG, I think they could have scored the third goal. If I'm Maurizio Pochettino, I am fuming about the wall. Just brief back on the wall. I'm absolutely fuming because at this level, in the semi-final of the Champions League, to lose a goal like that, if you get outpassed or De Bruyne has a bit of magic from 35 yards, your hands are up. But to concede a goal just through not being rigid with the wall, I would be so, so livid with that. And I think that they're now going to the second leg with an outside chance. But I think City have one foot in the final. And just a quick final word on Diaz, who I think should win the Player of the Year this year in England. I think he's been an absolute monster without doing anything again spectacular. I'm very excited about seeing him at the Euros this summer. And I'm also very excited about Van Dijk returning next year, because I would love to see those two at their best at some point in the next couple of years. But I think Ruben Diaz was absolutely phenomenal without overtly standing out, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think Diaz was great, but Kyle Walker as well, Philly.
Yep,
it's extraordinary. He's like getting quicker. He's like Jamie Vardy. He's drinking Jamie Vardy juice, getting older and getting quicker. His performance, bearing in mind he can attack, but he's got to think about Mbappe, and there was like one race between the two. It was
and
brilliant
to absolutely
see.
And well, we know that he's not. It's more than speed, actually, because he's got to be very careful with, obviously, with Kylian Mbappe, who, by the way, we thought was in, if not the form of his life, in terrific form until then. He was coming on the back of scoring two doubles, consecutive doubles in the French league. Look back to his best. And I have to say, I would give my man of the match award to Kyle Walker on this one. Very impressed, actually, from the word go, because the danger didn't come on his side. You will have, even in the first half, he was not completely overrun. It was on the other side that they were having primes, and in midfield. So yes, Kyle Walker. And one thing to go back on what Jordan was saying, the impression of calm that this team is exuding is really something else. It's hard to think that's the team that lost against Monaco or Tottenham or Lyon. Everything made sense. When you were listening to Riyad Mahrez and Kevin De Bruyne after the game, it's the calm with which they were talking. Yeah, we were not that good in the first half. We actually were a bit better in the second, but they were not. No, we were not transcendent or whatever. They just applied. They seemed to... It's the same qualities we saw against Borussia Dortmund, where they were in a tricky spot on a couple of occasions in both legs. You know, when Dortmund equalized, when they fell behind in the other leg. And no, they seemed to take it in their stride. Whereas the Manchester City we've known in previous seasons would probably not have been able to do that. And they're doing all of this without a number nine. Extraordinary.
Yeah, it's interesting they're doing it without a number nine. You wonder if, I mean, there's talk of Harry Kane at some point, you know, or Haaland. Do they need a number nine, Baz?
They're doing pretty well without one, but it's nice to have the option, isn't it? I thought maybe they might have brought Aguero on for the last 15 minutes last night, but didn't seem to need him, or Pep decided he didn't need him. So, but yeah, it is a good option to have, a good, I suppose, plan A1 or A.2.
Yeah, I suppose they can change their game, can't they? They've done so well with a classic Aguero type player that's not a classic Pep player. I thought Foden again, and you know, obviously we're now going to win the Euros, but that one run he did, it was... You know, oh no, I'm going to compare him to Paul Gascoigne. That's so ridiculous, Max.
I got a bit of heat for praising that run in a WhatsApp group last night because they were saying, well, he didn't score it, did he? There's no point if he didn't score it, which I thought was a little bit harsh. I thought that run was absolutely brilliant. If you look at it closely, again, I've got to watch it back, but he doesn't touch it with his right foot. It's all from he wins the ball. It's all left foot, left foot, left foot, left foot, left foot, striped with the outside of the left foot. It was a brilliant, brilliant run, I thought.
Yeah, but the pace and the strength Everything. It's a total joy. I mean, look, Mahrez as well is.
Yes.
Mahrez is coming into his own as well, Philippe.
Yes, he is. Like, and
he has been so good.
And showing qualities that perhaps we were not expecting from him. People have sometimes doubted his character, as in, the way he puts himself about on the pitch, there was absolutely no doubt. But there's been no doubt actually this season. And it's a bit of a worry. Raheem Sterling seems to have gone backwards in this kind of newfangled City, which doesn't quite play the same way as they did in the previous seasons. Mahrez has completely adapted to that and looks...
Do you think that is Sterling going backwards or just the other players going forwards quicker?
No,
I mean, it could be that Sterling is improving as well.
When I say going backwards, it's really unfair. I don't. The player hasn't got any worse or anything like that. That's not what I'm saying. He's not... maybe there is a bit of tiredness. That actually, we should come to that point. I mean, the difference in physical condition of both teams was absolutely staggering. It's more that, especially since Juan Malillo has arrived at Manchester City, it seems to me that they're playing with a little bit more control precisely in midfield, that they play at a different tempo, that they rely perhaps less on those blinding, on recuperating the ball really high up the pitch and then striking very quickly, which is the thing in which Raheem Sterling is absolutely superb, especially given his capacity to accelerate over the first few yards, his dribbling ability, all of this. And I don't think he's quite found a way to fit in that new style, so to speak. I mean, this is to be taken with a degree of caution and a big pinch of salt, because I'm not saying that he's been bad. No, far from it. What I'm saying is that Riyad Mahrez seems to have adapted far better to the changes which have taken place in Manchester City. By the way, just to come back to the striker, mm-hmm. In 2010, 2011, when probably the greatest team that Pep has ever coached, they had a number nine called David Villa. I mean, I can't see why they couldn't have a Haaland or a Harry Kane or somebody of that ilk complementing that. And once they've got that, well, good luck to the rest.
What's the point?
And then afterwards, okay, here's the trophy. Now, can we play between ourselves?
Quite a few people are suggesting that, both these ties are basically done. And I think that's definitely not true, isn't it? Yes, Chelsea are in the box seat. And yes, Manchester City absolutely are. But this could easily be a Real Madrid PSG final at the end of it. Jordan.
Yeah, I disagree with that as well. Yeah, the Chelsea tie for sure. That definitely is not done. There's legs in that. I do feel that if City score the first goal, I'm going into cliche mode now, but if they score the first goal in that second leg, with the defensive record that Manchester City have this season, I'd be very surprised if they concede three. So I think if they can get that first goal, that's tied done. That's why... I'm not even a City fan, but I was so angry last night just thinking, get the third, kill the tie. And they were actively just content with keeping the ball and seeing the game out. But no, I agree that those ties are not done by any stretch.
Do you get angry about a lot of things? I mean,
you know what? I don't, especially that. Other people's teams. Yeah. That's the weird thing about it.
What do you think, Baz?
I don't think either of them are over by any stretch of the imagination. PSG, I've for years questioned their absence or their mentality and looked at their lack of backbone as their major flaw. But there is no doubt on their day they are good enough to turn this around, absolutely. And I would say the same. I mean, I wouldn't write off Real Madrid for love or money. They're Real Madrid. We know what they can do.
Philippe, how big a miss is Idrissa Gana gave from that PSG midfield?
So I was just thinking about that, a big, big miss. He's been really, that midfield is a bit, it's an odd midfield. You've got Paredes, you've got Verratti, you've got Gay, Herrera can be in there. It's not, the best midfield on the planet. I would say Verratti is the outstanding player, and in this three, among these three or four. But Gay's role is absolutely crucial. He's the one who is getting to the ball, intercepting, who is constantly cutting the spaces, cutting the runs and so forth. So yes, they're going to miss him really, really big time. He also brings dynamism. He can bring the ball forward, which is not something like, for example, I mean, you would say Ender Herrera would be possibility, or Danilo perhaps, who's excelled, but more in a defensive capacity for PSG recently. But yes, they're going to miss him big time. The one thing, though, I must say, Max, for PSG, it might be, for once, they're put in a situation where they don't have to worry anymore about being ridiculous in the second leg, which has happened to them so often. So they might just be, yeah, let's just have fun, and with the players they've got, who knows? They might do something crazy. It's European football, it can happen, and they're not in this situation where they've won the first leg 3-0 or 4-0. Ha ha ha! Everything's fine, hands in pockets. And they get mugged at the exit of the nightclub. So that's not going to happen.
Can I just very briefly add, sorry, just on the red card, I think that that was a symptom. And I used the word earlier on about maturity. That for me felt like a team that was 2-1 down. And what City do to you, they piss you off, they frustrate you. You can't get the ball, they make you run, you're knackered, you're losing. So you just think, sod it, and you lash out. That's what they do to you. And I think in that moment, a 2-1, I think it was like 15 minutes left of the game. Take a 2-1 defeat. It's not great. You've got 10 men. You've got one of your key midfielders for the second leg. But their lack of maturity, I think, just led them to being really petulant and just quite nasty in that last 15 minutes of the game.
In that sod it moment, the football played by the greatest stars was exactly the same as the football played on the park on a Saturday afternoon.
It was like a
player taking himself off because he's been booked because he can't afford a red card. It's like, I've only got a tenner, I can't afford the rest of it.
What's the going rate for a red card?
Oh, I think it's 30. I'm not sure, actually.
Oh, wow.
No, I mean, you've got to really go some to get sent off our level, really.
Oh, my goodness. One tiny little thing, which is of importance before the return leg. City, more or less, well, they've got the title. It's just we're waiting. It's not a question of if, but when.
Sure.
PSG are in a real tight race.
It's amazing, isn't it?
And they're playing against Racing Club de Lens, which is still in the hunt for a place in Europe next season, at the weekend. They have a big game at the weekend. That will also have a... And given, you know, the physical state some of them look to be in, I think it may play a role as well.
Yeah, the Ligue 1 table, Lille are top, 73 points. PSG, 72. Monaco, 71. Lyon, 67. All from 34 games. That's so tight. I mean, you just presume by this time you'll look at the Ligue 1 table and PSG will be 20 points clear. Like, what would it mean for Pochettino if he doesn't win the Champions League or Ligue 1?
I would say that if he didn't win Ligue 1, to be honest, he wouldn't be entirely responsible for that, because the reason why PSG find themselves in this situation, because of an absolutely awful start to the season, which is great. I mean, I mentioned that with some other friends, that maybe the solution is to give PSG a handicap, like you give horses in the Grand National. They lost their first two games because they were absolutely knackered after the Champions League final against Bayern. And therefore, they had no preseason, couldn't prepare. They lost their first two games. And because of that, they've been constantly chasing the pack. And the pack, you know, has got... Lille is an absolutely wonderful, wonderful side with a wonderful manager, Christophe Galtier, and an absolutely extraordinary Yilmaz, who, you know, at the age of 35 is suddenly better than he's ever been. And so it's thrilling. And Monaco, do you remember, Max? I told you Monaco is my bet. It remains my bet, by the way.
All right.
I think they will peep them at the post.
Okay. Well, we will see what happens. All right. That'll do for part one. Kevin Miles from the Football Supporters Association joins for part two. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's bring in Kevin Miles, the Chief Executive of the Football Supporters Association. Kevin, how are you?
A little bit drained, to be honest, after a quite remarkable week. If somebody told me at the start of last weekend that I would end up on Tuesday in a Zoom meeting with the Prime Minister, collaborating on what can be done to stop the European Super League breakaway, I probably wouldn't have believed you. But it's been a remarkable sequence of events, probably one of the shortest-lived competitions ever devised, which... over and done within 72 hours from conception to death. But it, I mean, it, fantastic display of fan power, but also unity across the rest of the game with you know, fans, players, most sensible football administrators, even everybody but billionaires, seeing immediately through the anti-competitive nature of this, the greed that lies behind it. And it was, you know, fantastic to see it collapse. It was it was a little bit like watching election night on a particularly good year. And I think it was just, was it Tuesday night when the clubs were, you know, announcing that they were peeling away from it. It was like a Portillo moment after another as the clubs withdrew.
What were the soft furnishings like behind the Prime Minister in his Zoom meeting?
they by which I mean government, were sat in a big long room around a big wooden table, as big as you can imagine, as big as you'd expect. And they were a little bit at the far end of a room. We actually, the Prime Minister tweeted a picture, a photograph of from behind him at the Zoom screen. I could actually, well, my family are too great delight in picking out my face with Boris taking notes from what I was saying. A very unlikely scenario, really.
Genuinely, because I think a lot of people feel, look, it's going to come back again in some way. And fans, we don't really, you know, it was great to see us all complaining about this, but actually we don't really have any power. Do fans have any power? And what can they do to get more power?
Actual power, I think the answer to that is at the moment, by no means enough. And I think that's something that needs to be addressed now. I think what we do have at the minute is a bit of wind in our sails and a bit of momentum behind the idea that we should have some power. A bit of idea as well. I think you're absolutely right. This, left alone, this will come back, because this Super League proposal is just the culmination of the trajectory that football has been on for the last 20 years, where there's been a bigger and bigger accumulation of money at the top, that there's been more and more interference in the game from outside financial interest to want to make money out of it, to take money out of the game. There's been an increasingly uneven distribution of wealth, and that's been something that's been getting worse, and this is just the natural next expression of it. So the whole thing needs a reset. The question is, how can that be done? And I think most people now have reached the conclusion that the football authorities, because these people are built into the foundations of their own power structures, the football authorities cannot any longer be relied upon to regulate the game themselves. They are too beholden to these financial interests. And therefore, it's going to take outside interference, which will give that power to fans and the other stakeholders in the game. Now, I think we have a real chance to do that this time, in a way that you know, there's a new impetus given to this by the, if you like, the whip of counter-revolution, if you like, this proposal for the breakaway has been the one thing that has spurred people into action and overcome their doubts about it. So I have high hopes from that the fan-led review will be followed up by parliamentary time to create legislation to back up the powers of regulatory functions and a change in the ownership model that means that the fan voice is built in at every level of the game. Now, that could... Government has the power to give fans the power in the game to make a real difference, to have a decisive say on the important issues in the game.
There is, I think, very striking thing, Kevin, has been the fact that some fans who are supposedly the owners of their clubs, those of Real Madrid and Barcelona, were put in front of a fait accompli and absolutely did nothing. And yet it was left to English fans to be the public voice of disapproval and condemnation, which is the way it has been, by the way, felt on the continent. Now, this issue has got nothing to do with the European Union and so forth or Brexit. It's about UEFA, it's about European football, which is completely different. Do you think the English fans and, you know, organizations like your own and also Supporters Trust, do you think you can reach out to other associations across the continent to actually fight together? If, for example, I'm thinking we've got this new formula of the Champions League from 2024-25 onwards, which can still be changed. Why not, for example, you know, the FSA teaming up with the guys in Germany, in France, in Scandinavia, wherever it is, to actually have a real impact at European level, at UEFA level?
It's such a brilliant idea, Philippe, that we've already done it, in the sense that we are part of a European-wide organisation, Football Supporters Europe, which has been, up till now, the official dialogue partner of UEFA around all of these fans' issues, and have been heavily involved in the mobilisation against the European Super League. That we've been in, you know, as I mean, I sit on the board of Football Supporters Europe, and we've been in, you know, constant discussions with UEFA, with the European leagues, and, you know, with fan groups across the whole of the continent. I mean, the landscape of football fan organisation across Europe is a very varied one. I mean, UEFA is made up of 55 national associations, which are very varied in themselves, and the level of organisation and the consciousness and, you know, involvement of fans varies enormously across those countries as well. So it's not just a question of corralling the, you know, supporters organisations like they exist in England all into one unified group. There are some very well developed fans organisations and countries with a good structure, and then there are others which are way behind. But we're already definitely doing that on the European level. So we have the promise of a meeting with Čeferin from Football Supporters Europe, where we'll be taking along fan groups representatives from not just the English clubs, but the Spanish clubs, who did their best. There were fan groups and the Spanish clubs trying to get involved in this campaign. They're obviously in a weaker position, starting point, than the fan groups in England were. But we have reached out across the German fans, and, you know, well, Football Supporters Europe organises across the whole of Europe, and we'll definitely be coordinating the European level, because I think it clearly has implications. There are negotiations underway now. We are pressing for the scrapping of the reforms to the Champions League proposals. And I think already probably there is enough momentum against this historic coefficient as a means of qualifying for the tournament. I think there's enough momentum against that already. You could pretty safely say that will not survive. But we don't want to see any increase in the size of the competition, the number of games either. We'll be pushing back on all of that. And I think, as I said, just in the domestic situation, the wind is in our sails a little bit. I think there's, you know, people are having to sit up and listen in a way that they wouldn't before. And they've all, as well, looked over the abyss and seen what it could be like. And they're all, you know, definitely backing off from that now and looking for alternatives.
Hi, Kevin. The government were talking very tough on the Monday and the Tuesday, Oliver Dowden, Boris Johnson, about saving English football. This is not going to happen. They were really coming out in a very tough speaking way. I feel they were let off the hook massively by the U-turn, because then they didn't have to do anything, really. The job was done for them. How much faith do you have that the government will indeed see this through and actually make this fan-led review a serious thing? Because it's very easy in a country like England, where we love football so much, to talk tough. It plays well to English people in this country for votes and political reasons. But how much faith do you have that they actually will, now that they've not had to do anything in the first stage, actually see this through and ensure that, as you say, the fans do have more of a say in the runnings of their football clubs?
Faith's an interesting word. I don't think I have blind faith in anybody in politics or in football administration, for that matter, to necessarily deliver on what they say. However, it's not just about the faith and their good intentions. It's about the balance of forces, and it's about what they're under pressure to do. We do have currently a Prime Minister who, in that meeting with us, his opening sentences were explaining how he's been having pressure from his own backbenchers, questioning what is a free market conservative like himself doing, talking about state intervention and government involvement in putting together a competition issue in sport. And his answer to that was, well, he hasn't changed from being a free market conservative. However, the other side of the role of government is to protect the natural heritage, the culture, the fabric of society. And he's clearly got an appetite for a bit of a populist appeal. And I think a feeling that people up north in those red wall constituencies like football, don't they? So it's a good area of activity to be involved in. So there's a coming together of interests, I think. At least in the short term. It was interesting, in the discussion we had with some of the politicians, there was a bit of a separation out of the two things. They said, right, the first thing we need to do is to stop the European Super League. We are aware that there are issues about the governance of football and the distribution of wealth and all those sorts of issues. And that's what the Fanled Review is for. And they've announced the creation of the Fanled Review on the Monday afternoon. So they have a plan for dealing with the longer term. I think this gives us a once-in-a-generation opportunity. Because as far as I can see, the way it's going to be structured, this term, I mean, I don't think everybody knows precisely what fan-led means, but it suggests it's a departure from previous events where you've thrown all of the football authorities and every stakeholder in football in the room together and told them to come up with a consensus. If that's your starting point, you're never going to get agreement and you'll get it watered down to the lowest common denominator. I think we have an opportunity here to get something different. I think in the chair of the process, Tracy Crouch, I think you have as good a person as you could get in terms of having the political credibility with the government, as well as a genuine understanding of the game and what the issues are. I think you'll have, she'll be strong enough, I think, to take evidence from all parties, but actually come up with a solution that works rather than something which is just, you know, the least unpalatable to the biggest number of people. I think we have an opportunity to get something really effective here. But I mean, you're absolutely right. You can't just hope and you take them all at their word. Some people have been pushed to a position in the course of the last few weeks by public pressure that they haven't taken before. And we've got to make sure that pressure is maintained so they don't back off from it and go back to the easy life. Football is something that requires action. It requires changing. It requires sorting out. And there is a danger that the dust settles and everybody gets bored and goes back to business as usual. And we have to make sure that doesn't happen.
We obviously saw lots of fans mobilised, you know, outside Arsenal, outside Chelsea, protesting, you know, singing Spurs fans, singing songs at Wembley and all the other clubs. We've had half our audiences all over the world, right? But they also hated the European Super League. We sort of had this slightly naive idea that perhaps fans abroad were more interested in it. How important is it for those fans to not just mobilise outside Chelsea that day, but to join their trust or to join the FSA to basically make fan groups more powerful?
The fan voice in this space is absolutely crucial. And the more credible, the louder it is, the more numerous it is, the better in this particular area. And I think you're right. I think it cuts across all sorts of club divides. An infringement against sporting principles involved in this particular way, which I think anybody who really understands sport across the whole of the world will understand. But it's interesting, I mean, this idea that there is a new fan internationally that completely wants to just see you can dispense with the old legacy fans and just build around the new ones as well, I think it's an absolute fallacy. And even some of the research carried out by the football authorities themselves suggest that. I remember the Premier League did some research a few years ago among fans in Thailand about who are television fans, obviously. And one of the things that they asked them was, how would they feel about Manchester United against Liverpool being played in Bangkok and having the opportunity to get 50,000, 60,000 to go actually see a real competitive league fixture between Manchester United and Liverpool. And this is, you know, around the time, just before Game 39 was being mooted. And what they found from the research, the feedback they got from the fans in Thailand was that they weren't interested in having it there because it wouldn't be a genuine Manchester United-Liverpool game. They wanted the atmosphere that went with the game at Old Trafford or at Anfield, and they would rather have the chance of winning a once-in-a-lifetime possibility to attend the real thing with its atmosphere than have it transplanted across to Bangkok and have it played in a different environment and be guaranteed a ticket to it. So even among these fans who are the young fans watching TV, I think there is, among most of those, there is an understanding of what goes into making the English game so special. It's about atmosphere, it's about the competitive basis of it, it's about the tradition, all that sort of stuff. And I don't think they can dispense with that. And I mean, if you're looking for comedy in this, Agnelli's suggestion about selling subscriptions for the last 15 minutes only of games because young people have a poor attention span. I mean, the number of games I've seen where the last 15 minutes has been absolutely terrible as somebody tries to hold on to a lead, and you can imagine people gathered around a corner flag trying to keep the ball out away from any meaningful activity at all. The idea you're going to get sell subscriptions for that, I mean, it's laughable, isn't it?
One final thing, Kevin. The social media boycott we're taking part. You were sort of a big part of making this happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's in and of itself, that boycott over the weekend is not going to change the world, but I think hopefully it will bring home to the social media companies exactly how important football and sport is to them, that they'll have a rethink about how inadequate their measures to tackle this have been, and they'll do something a little bit more robust in this area. And I think it sends a clear signal of where we stand on all these things. So we were very pleased to have fans considered as a stakeholder involved in this. I think is also a step forward. It's not just the football authorities treating fans as the problem. We fans, as always in these issues, are part of the solution, not the problem. And I think, you know, we're really pleased to get behind this.
Football Weekly is taking part. We won't be tweeting out for questions. We won't be tweeting out next Monday's pod until Tuesday morning. It'll presumably drop into your feed as normal. The whole of Guardian Sport is taking part as well. Will Woodward, our boss, said this move should be seen in hand with our commitment to keep reporting on and investigating this important subject, including an in-depth special report in the coming weeks. We generally aren't in favour of boycotts or blackouts and believe news and robust comment are essential, but the relentless abuse must stop. It's important to take a stand. If you do have a question over the weekend, you can email us, a newfangled way of getting in touch. footballweekly@theguardian.com. It is worth noting that we lost the login a couple of years ago, so apologies if you've sent us something in that time. And the really good news is, Barry, all the emails are coming to you, apparently. So, yeah. So, Barry's mailbag begins on Monday. Football Weekly.
What? Hold on. No one told me.
Well,
this.
We're telling you now. Apparently,
not only do I have to get to grips with this amazing new technology, why me?
Well, because apparently I can't, because I don't have a Guardian email. I don't have a Guardian email address, so I can't get them.
Well, get one.
I can't have one. Apparently, IT can't sort it.
I don't even reply to emails from my own family.
So there you go. Barry's mailbag starts on Monday. footballweekly@theguardian.com. Kevin, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Kevin Miles there from the Football Supporters Association. We'll be back in a second. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. footballweekly@theguardian.com, by the way. That's the email address if you want to get in touch with us. Or if you just have any questions.
But don't feel compelled to get in touch.
Any questions about anything to do with the Guardian.
I've emailed already, Barry. So.
So Premier League is back this weekend. City can get a step closer to the title. They're the early kickoff on Saturday away at Crystal Palace in the race for the top four. Manchester United and Liverpool, probably the pick of the game. Spurs play Sheffield United. Luke says, with Kane hinting that he wants to leave Spurs and play at a higher level, which team do you think will get him, Leicester or West Ham? He won the Player of the Year at the London Football Awards, which is part of Bob Wilson's brilliant Willow Foundation. Individual awards are great. They are fantastic achievements. When I look back at the end of my career, these are the things I will go over and take in more. But the goal right now as a player is to win team trophies. I want to be winning the biggest prizes there are to offer. And we're not quite doing that. Not quite. We sort of mentioned it before. Can you see him being in a different shirt next season, Philippe?
I can't see why not. I don't think it's one of those cases where you have a player would be betraying his club. I mean, he served his club magnificently. He's perhaps stayed at the club longer than some of us expected him to. And he's coming to an age as well. What is he, 28 now? He will be 28, yeah. He's in his 28th year, where he obviously needs to be looking somewhere else to win the trophies that he thinks his talent warrants. And I think anybody else thinks his talent warrants. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And I think there's an awful lot of Spurs fans who are still hanging on to the hope that he will stick with us, but would, I think, completely understand his decision if he decided to go to a club. I mean, not any club, of course, Jordan.
No. I was just going to say the issue here for me is the fee. I mean, Daniel Levy's not going to let him go for a cut price fee, even during COVID times.
Who can afford it?
Who can afford to put down 120, 140 million, which I think Daniel Levy will want? I don't think even your Paris is in your... I don't think go to City. Who can afford? I think there's a strong chance he could be at Spurs next season, because I just don't... There's not a massive market of teams that I think will put down a package that I think Daniel Levy will be satisfied with.
Why do you say he wouldn't go to City, Jordan?
I don't think City will A, spend the money that I think Levy will want. I just don't see them putting down 100 plus million for a striker. And I've got kind of early point to our earlier discussion in the pod. I think that they are not going to go all out for a striker of the fee. I think they may well run with this non-striker thing, keep Gabriel Jesus as like the second choice, if you like, and play with this role. I don't think they're going to go out and buy a marquee striker this summer, personally.
Also, and this is for a couple of years' time, but I think they've just signed a guy who plays in South America called Kai Kai, who is absolutely,
he's
17,
good.
But ludicrous. Yep. And it's what he's a sort of attacking midfielder. So it's what they need. And, you know, it's good because they they need to get competitive, don't they, Manchester City?
Yes. Sorry, Max, but you could imagine him at Manchester United, for example. They don't have a proper number nine. Why not Manchester United?
Yeah.
I'm even thinking, why not? I mean, it doesn't have to be an English club anyway. It can be, you know, and who can afford him at the moment? Not very many, but Bayern Munich could afford him. Lewandowski is getting on a little bit. Why not have two number nines? Hey, I don't know. Generally, with things like that, where there's a will, there's a way.
Pochettino knows him, PSG, possible?
Well, it's also a possibility, because you could again say that PSG do not really have a full-on number nine. I mean, Mauro Icardi is probably the closest they've got, but is, with apologies to Icardi fans, is nowhere as good as Harry Kane. So why not? And they've got the money, and there's no financial fair play regulations in place.
For the few of you that listen to this pod before the Europa League games are played, Manchester United, Roma, the return of Chris Smalling, Villarreal, Arsenal, the revenge of Unai Emery in those two games. Lots of people are interested, Philippe, in your views on Daniel Ek, the Spotify billionaire. Obviously, you've made a lot of money out of Spotify, Philippe.
I am absolutely thrilled, and especially, you know, this is April. This is a month in which we get our royalty statements from all our publishers and various things. So I'm absolutely thrilled, yes, to have banked. I'm not even going to say you how much I banked from Spotify, because it's really embarrassing. It's really embarrassing. And I think it's a very unfair question that you're asking me. I think I've made that clear when I thought about Spotify in the past.
Mm-hmm.
What I find very interesting, though, is the fact that you can see two different kinds of capitalism here at stake. You've got the old-fashioned capitalism, which is the crunk sports and entertainment, which is traditional model. Everybody hates them. I mean, for reasons which are fairly obvious.
Barry thinks they're great, he said.
They're great. And they don't want Arsenal to fail. Obviously, they don't want that. They want their investment to do well, but they're involved in old-fashioned capitalism. Ek is involved in the capitalism I bore more than any other form of capitalism, the most horrendous, awful, sickening type of capitalism, because not only is it exploiting people, vampirizing them, but it's pretending to be cool. And that is that's the thing that makes me that causes revulsion in my body, that makes my, and when I'm, as I'm talking to you, I'm looking at my hands, and I've got the same reaction as I have when if I found a spider under my pillow. It's raised. It's like Ek is like, it's like this gigantic spider pretending to be nice. He's not nice. He's horrible. He's at the head of a company which has made him a billionaire, without paying people properly, by exploiting living people who are living, and by never turning a profit. And the way these guys make their money is by issuing, it's like share issues, giving themselves share issues, and they become worth billions. That's how they make their money, not through a normal business model. So if you're happy with that, cool, but that's not my club. I don't want anything to do with it. And I mean it. I genuinely mean it.
I agree with Philippe about the ethics of how these people become owners and what that says about us as football fans. And maybe the horse is bolted out of the yard already. But I the way he's playing this out publicly, I just think is very, very cringe. He's trying to bring in these legends to make it a bit more credible and cool. The whole thing stinks to me. And I think his whole trying to buy the club, this method, I just don't think that's how you convince other billionaires to sell.
We started to hear about the involvement of Patrick Vieira, Dennis Bergkamp and Thierry Henry. The tweet was on Friday. Then we heard over the weekend and on Monday that the players were backing this bid, a bid which, by the way, hadn't been put in place, which hadn't got finances, anything. Anyway, let's imagine that was the case. Funnily enough, when I was taking some feelers in the agents' world at the time, everybody was very cagey about it. Nobody was saying, yes, they're with it or they're behind it. Strangely enough, following the intervention of one of those agents, suddenly the thing started to get a bit of traction. And what the feeling I get is that you had a typical thing, like you had a draft and people going in the draft and trying to hang on the coattails thinking, ooh, there might be something in it for me. Not the opposite. So the whole thing is like this gigantic souffle, which was started by a guy creating a chemical reaction by publishing a tweet. That's all there was to it. And then suddenly everything goes woof. It goes up. People think, oh, that's great. Let's get into that. And this is how the rumors of the involvement of Vieira, Bergkamp and Henry, which might be real now, started. It was completely as a consequence. It was not part of the bid or attempt at a bid that Eck had to start with. You see, the distinction is very important. It's hot air.
Yeah, the analogy of the Emirates being a giant souffle is quite accurate, I think, isn't it? It's just one pinprick.
The whole thing dear. Falls apart.
Anyway. And joining us now, Daniel Eck on the pod.
I'd love to chat to him. I'd love to talk to him.
Real Madrid are seeking special dispensation to excuse Marcelo from working at a polling station during next week's local election. It's a brilliant story. It clashes with their game against Chelsea. He's been selected to monitor elections to the Madrid Assembly on Tuesday, and he's at risk of missing it. There is precedent here. A Levante goalkeeper, Aitor Fernandez, was cleared to play in a game at Athletic Bilbao. He was excused from working at a polling station in Mondragon. Initially, his appeal was rejected by the local electoral commission. This was in 2019. He said, I just want to know what's going on. I'm fully focused on the game. If need be, I can sleep at home, go down to the station, then get myself to the game by car. I love that idea. But Marcelo running off from polling station after he's done. Anyway, I'm sure he'll play, won't he? Jeff Beers says, an alligator crashed Toronto's training in Florida this week. A, which wild animal would be the best at football? And B, which animal would Barry underestimate as much as Iheanacho? Thoughts?
Well, I've seen elephants mm-hmm. play football, but they're not exactly nimble. I don't think they'd have a place in Man City's front three.
No, you wouldn't play on wing-back, would you?
And it wasn't there that clip doing the rounds a couple of months ago of a couple of deer playing football and one of them scored a goal and ran off in celebration. So, and I used to have a little Jack Russell Terrier in Ireland who was pretty handy on the ball, yeah. But she wasn't a wild animal.
Can I throw in a shark? Now, I get the logistics of that being difficult out of water. Mm. But I was told a fun fact a few years back that sharks actually get faster as they go through the water. So the idea of a winger, I'm thinking of like a raw fox. Raw fox always used to seem to get faster and faster and faster and faster before shooting or passing. So I'm gonna go for a great white shark.
So raw fox's final ball wasn't amazing. And you imagine...
There you go.
Jaws' final ball, you know, could get there... There's no, once Burst again, it. You're like, fucking hell, Jaws. Just lamping it out for a goal kick again.
Meerkats, perhaps, like in the wall. You know, they have the natural attitude. Yep. Better than the PSG, that's for sure.
Had it been six meerkats, would it still be 1-1 in the second leg? And Joey says, what do Hull need to do to get a mention on the pod? Gained promotion at the weekend, probably going to win the league, been around top all season, yet not one mention of Hull at all. We get comprehensive roundups of Sunderland and Cambridge every week. I reckon Champions League quarterfinal, and then then we'll do a Hull special. Jacek says, not a question, can you please give a shout out to Artur Boruch, who just secured his second Polish league title with Legia Warsaw after 19 years. He did it in 2002 and he did it in 2021. He is still very much at it at 41. Good for you, Artur. We salute you. That'll do for today's pod. A reminder, if you want to get in touch with any questions for Monday's pod, we are taking part in the social media blackout. We're not going to read out tweets, but Barry will go through every email, footballweekly@theguardian.com. Barry, thank you for your time. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, man.
Jordan, thanks, mate.
Anytime.
Cheers, Philippe.
Thank you.
Back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.